This is the second half. I want to just explain a little tiny bit of context. Steve Schwab, who is immediately behind me, has a grant, who's one of the 29 folks, to look at the issue of security architecture for Genie. And he's going to give he's published I think it's on 0.4 version of this document. And he's going to talk about that. He's going to give a summary of that. And then we have sort of quick reports from each of the control framework folks about what they're doing. And what I asked them to do was to, Steve as well, I didn't have to ask Steve, he already knew. I didn't want to bring a lot of detail to this conversation, but I wanted to ask questions of the form, is this something that's of primary interest to you, or are you just kind of throwing something together? I wanted to ask questions of the form, what is your sense of sort of the problem statement here? So this isn't as much about proposing particular mechanisms as it is about understanding what the security architecture needs to do, what its capabilities should be, what its scope should be, how much commonality there needs to be, things of that sort, as well as whether, in fact, there are mechanisms that, or ideas or concepts or architectural frameworks that any particular group would bring to the table that they think are particularly powerful to address some of these issues. So what we're going to do is Steve's going to start, we're going to try to keep the whole set of presentations to not quite the full hour, and then have a little discussion.
Okay, I get to find out if not having a Mac is a bad choice today. Oh, maybe. I have those at home too, but you know, it's a corporate thing. So I'm Steve Schwab from Cobham. Oh, okay. Just a quick, let's see, so full billing. This work is joint with my colleague, Alifia Hussein, who's not here today. Just an outline. I want to talk just a little bit about the security architecture draft. This is a work in progress. We intend to update this draft roughly at 6-month intervals as the spirals continue. So there'll be a spiral one version, then we'll continue to evolve in future spirals. So this is as much a advertisement for read the document and throw tomatoes or make positive comments where you see fit. But let us know where things are. We're trying to incorporate a lot of ideas. We're starting in a very small corner of the space. And then I'll make some observations about candidate technologies and try to share some considerations for the control framework security implementation. So I may hold a lot of those comments for the discussions of the specific implementation. So our objective in Spiral 1 is really, we're looking at near-term security design documentation. And this is, this is really a something aimed at the evolving DNP, development and prototyping implementation. So we're going to try to not necessarily fall too far behind, not necessarily lead too far ahead of where things are, but deal with things that are current for the folks who are in the trenches trying to build systems that work. Cobham acquired Sparta, the previous name, which our research lab operated under about a year ago. We've officially rebranded as Cobham. I think this is the fifth title for the lab since Trusted Information Systems days, and I'm sure number 6 is not too far away, but you'll see different names on different slides. It's all the same people. Nothing's changed except for the sign on the door. One thing specifically, we're not building things in Spiral 1. We are looking over folks' shoulders and consulting. And so the work going on in debugging things is in the control frameworks. Okay, so just a quick overview of the security architecture draft. So threat model. There was a lot of work in the earlier iterations of Genie planning on threat model. I think we adopted most of those ideas and captured them succinctly in the current draft. But we generally believe Genie researchers are the ones who will be authenticated and authorized to use some subset of available resources within a control framework. And so we just heard from Larry, there's mechanisms for specifying what you're going to get in RSpecs, and some privileges will be invoked to decide whether you're going to get those. And then there's a series of threats related to external attacks, accidental experiments, slice isolation, But really, we expect these things to be, in some sense, slices are isolated, but they also live on the internet. So we have to deal with the full range of threats we know about already, plus the ones we introduce through our experimenters' behavior, which may not really be malicious so much as new code running on platforms with idiosyncratic behavior. So we should adjust our thinking towards that threat model. We certainly are looking for feedback. Now, in terms of trust model, explicit trust assertions are sort of hardwired now into our thinking on the security architecture. So there's trust between the resources, researchers and the resource owners, the authorities managing things. And there's this implicit notion there, which is called out, because this is a distributed system of distributed components, that there's local decision making. I'm contributing these resources, so ultimately I may delegate to some other level of the system, but ultimately decisions being made locally about whether this guy can use my resources or use my network. And I think that's consistent with the view that there's a large number of contributors of resources into this evolving system. And so there's got to be a mechanism whereby somebody can exercise control over their boxes, their gear, their networks, whatever. And this is not without some contention, but I believe that this is the right way to think about building a system that's going to scale. Now, along with the explicit trust, if you look at some of the major points in the security architecture, there's a number of them which you think of as core security kinds of things: least privilege, being able to revoke rights granted either through timeouts or through explicit revocation, and a notion of auditability and accountability, so we can operate this system and reach back and find out what happened when something went wrong. There's also a set of points that you would not necessarily assume are security: the scalability and the autonomy of local components in the system, usability and the performance with respect to the security architecture. These are all really first-order issues that we have to take into account in building the security architecture in terms of things which will prevent the system from really working at scale and over time. So there's a bit of creep here. We touch on a lot of other parts of the system in ways that you might not at first blush assume would have to be considered by security. And so we're looking for either additional points that folks think strongly have to be addressed, or also comments on where there's difference of opinions on how we might in fact work around some of those points and not necessarily address them head on in the security section of the overall design. Okay, so mechanisms in Spiral 1, and these are really the things that folks who are building prototypes are working on right now. Everyone has identity and authentication for their users. There's some authorization model, and there's some way of granting access control. And so we go over that in a somewhat architecturally neutral way about describing what those things are. So in principle, anyone could come along later and build a control framework. We've also got fairly, not detailed, but a medium level of abstraction talking about how each of the control frameworks are pursuing their own paths towards realizing that security in Spiral 1. So somebody can take a quick overview and get a sense of where things are going and maybe where the similarities and differences are in between the different control frameworks, and so see kind of how they're covering the space. Because it's hard, I know in myself, following the different groups, it can be hard to see where things are going and how things are lining up and where things are fundamentally different. Okay, so one other thing that's in the security architecture draft, there's a Spiral 1 action items list. And this, Heidi asked me to put in, there are things to consider if you're going to deploy any of these prototypes on your campus or at a site. Things like roots of trust and who are the POCs and what operational information you need to for contacting somebody if something goes wrong, and what sort of audits or source code reviews should be done on the deployment. So we'll have a discussion touching on some of those more operational security issues tomorrow in the OMIS working group. And there's a part of the document which begins to address some of those concerns, which aren't really about building the control frameworks, but more like what do we do when we stand them up and start running them in the environments where we expect to deploy things. And that's still, I think we need a lot of feedback from a different set of people, regarding what will work, what won't work in the university environment. More of my background comes from corporate and government security, where the rules and the behaviors are a little bit different about what would be deployed. But the universities have their own challenges, as we all know, and there's in some cases the rules are more stringent in some ways. In terms of candidate technical mechanisms we've got on the table, we think one that was built in our lab, attribute-based access control, is worth looking at in detail. We've got it described in fair detail in the draft, and we describe it not so much as the concrete particular implementation, but as a way of looking at the sort of mechanisms that are appropriate for addressing the problems that have come up in building this distributed Gini security kind of system. There's a URL to the draft. It's on the wiki page for the Gini security stuff. And please do read and comment, and we are looking for feedback. So let me flip quickly into observations on Spiral 1. So we've got a number of candidate technologies different folks are adopting in their current work just to get either to get things done or to provide evolution along a longer-term path. So we've got, if you think about security, we've got things like HTTPS to a centralized website, and antivirus scanners, and PGP, email encryption, things that in some sense are well-known, fully developed, and deployed at scale, meaning internet scale. There's no question they can be deployed widely. We've got some other things. DNSSEC has been under development in our lab for perhaps 10 years, finally is kind of starting to roll out at scale. We've got X509 PKIs, which have been deployed in some small sense, but never until recently really large-scale deployments. But these are technologies that we think really will deploy at scale. And then there's a lot of mature research prototypes, ABAC and the SHARP work that is evolving and being used in Jeff Chase's ORCA framework. These are things which we have in hand, we know they work, but you can point out they've never probably been deployed at scale in an internet setting. And so there's some question, what's going to take to move those technologies into a maturity that they can be deployed and operated at scale? And so, you know, we want to be careful about what we choose. We want to choose things that'll let us get up and running right away, but we also, you know, sort of have a desire to make sure we're picking security technologies that will let us have cutting-edge technologies securing the Gini infrastructure without necessarily saying pick an immature new research idea, which is sort of over the horizon, something that really should be investigated in Gini versus something we have in hand now. In terms of the Spiral 1 tenets of the architecture, if you will, we've got authenticated identity and authorizations that are separate. We've got explicit credentials for authorization, and the goals there are flexibility and scale. And so I'm going to just talk kind of quickly about two of those technologies just to sort of paint a picture of how that would actually work to support these kinds of ideas, make sure it's clear that these aren't necessarily things that are far over the horizon, but match up with things we know how to do now. Okay, so let's... In thinking about this, we've got these identities for every potentially unique entity in Gini, not just the researchers, but potentially the slice authorities and management authorities and components, and potentially the clearinghouse that play a different role. And we have these authorizations that are built up from primitive statements about what those identities are and, you know, how they're trusted to do something. And so there's two points. Anyone or any entity, in some sense, can act as an authority for things that it's empowered to do, and it can delegate those rights to other places in the system. And so they're not complicated ideas, but they give a lot of power if you have these available in your security machinery. In terms of the authentication of the principals acting, we expect to use a public key mechanism. It's not the only mechanism possible, but public key mechanism seems to fit best with the kinds of distributed systems we want. And we've got these registries, which are not necessarily the authoritative place that this information has to be, but you can check in a registry when needed, not necessarily required, to see if that public key is active or if there's some certificate revocation list. So you've got a notion of, you've got this public key you can just use, and you've got some other place where you can get some hints, if necessary, about what's going on with that key. Okay, so here's probably the cornerstone to think about. What entities are the trusted principals? What are these things we've authenticated? What are the assertions we want to make? And it's really, the question is one of expressiveness. What complexity of assertions do we need to make? Do we just need to assign a fixed set of privileged bits? Do we need to be able to make more complicated statements? Those are sort of the choices when we pick a particular technology to use. And then what kind of reasoning can we make about a combination of those statements? What rules are being used to combine those attributes? And is this algorithm being used to make these inferences, is it an implicit one in the particular technology, or is it some explicit set of rules that we can configure later? And from a security architecture viewpoint, you know, we're absolutely not locking ourselves into any technology, probably now in Spiral 1 or even in Spiral 2 or 3. We'll probably, I think almost certainly, expect to have two or more of these sorts of trust systems running all the time in Genie. And over time, as new ones come, we have to plug them in. But the fundamental DNA of the system, I believe, can be expected to have this kind of abstraction inside it. So let's just look at a couple that are in play without necessarily committing to either. So Shibboleth, it's widely deployed. It's a well-known system in the university environment. Single sign-on, it's tied somewhat to a web browser, web server model. And so we've got an overview of how an identity provider and a service provider play a role with a user in the middle of the protocol, normally to access a web page. But in fact, we could easily use it, and I think, Jeff, I think you probably are using it, to access something else, a resource in a component manager. And the key thing here is that this really maps quite well onto things like we've got an attribute authority, and that's where we're making these assertions. And we've got a service provider, and it's the one that's receiving those assertions and following the reasoning chain and making decisions about that. And we've got a representation, the SAML, that we can describe, you know, the expressiveness of those assertions. Okay, and so this trust structure works, helps a large community of these ID providers and service providers to interoperate. Okay, another technology, homegrown in our research lab, attribute-based access control. Essentially, at some level, you know, can be thought of as isomorphic, though there's different pieces that have maybe perhaps more flexibility. So you've got chains of digitally signed credentials, and their storage is distributed around in whichever repositories made those assertions. And essentially, those attributes define what kind of access control permissions we're going to grant. And so we've got this diagram that essentially shows how from various control frameworks, you'd pull out credentials, and there'd be a trust negotiation algorithm as information goes back and forth until an aggregate manager on one side has enough credentials to conclude definitively that some resource should be granted, and then that operation proceeds, and now there's a resource in a slice, or denies, and you get back a denial. And there's a principled way this all takes place. So, you know, we have attributes that talk about what the subjects, you know, the entities can do. Resource attributes about what's being asserted about the components or the things in the aggregate managers they control, and some other environment attributes which give us a rich way of adding additional information, additional assertions into the system. And so, just a typical kind of prototypical example. Is the local site, somebody designates faculty, and they have control over their slivers, and those slivers perhaps have the rights to shut down any slice in which that sliver participates. It's a fairly simple assertion chain, but it gives you the flexibility to do the kinds of things we need. And we can also imagine a situation that's a little more complicated, in which any entity that is both, say, the creator and the administrator for some resource has the ability of shutting down that whole slice if they detect something wrong on that local resource. So the complexity of any of these assertions is fairly small. You get most of the power out of the system, and you haven't necessarily hardwired in that this identity has these privileges and this identity has these privileges, and created a nightmare of very fine-grained privileges that now have to be managed for potentially thousands of users. And with that, I think we should turn over to the control framework guys and let them talk a little bit about what they're building in each of the specific control frameworks.
I'm going to be real fast, and in fact, I don't have a security slide specifically, but I have a very high-level description of the Genie implementation we have, which we call Genie Wrapper, because it's a front end to Planet Lab and all the federated partners that we have, and security is in this implementation almost exactly as it's described in the SLICE facility architecture document. So if you go read that document, what you will see is that almost all the operations take a credential as an argument, and the credential encodes a set of rights that this particular, and is then signed up through a set of authorities, and if I trust the root, then I will trust that this particular holder of the credential has the right to invoke that. Everything that you see here is just describing the implementation. And so, starting with OpenSSL, we have built up a set of classes, including a credential class. That class is then, that is an argument to virtually every operation that you can make in the system. The thing on the right is the set of Genie objects, if you will, that are relevant. SFI is the SLICE facility interface. It's a Unix command that the users type to manipulate Genie things. It accumulates the credentials that are required, and then it uses the appropriate credential on any particular call, which is implemented by a class called the Genie Client, which is implemented on top of XML RPC. And on the other side, the aggregate will accept your credential, the registry will accept your credential, the slice manager and the component manager will accept your credential, and basically verify the signatures are appropriate and crack open the privilege that is contained in there, and we'll go look up to see if that privilege implies the right to invoke the operation you're trying to invoke. So that check is made on every single call. And if you want someone to operate on your behalf, then you explicitly delegate that right to the other entity, and that credential basically encapsulates that right. Nearly every word up there, except in parentheses, is the name of a file. If you wanted to go look through the implementation, just put .py at the end of it. And if you start at sfi.py, you can actually trace and follow the flow of the credentials through the system. It's really not that much code. And if you look in rights.py, you will actually see a table in the implementation that looks just like the table in section 5.4 of the SFA document, which says these sorts of users have the right to invoke these kinds of operations and so on. And that's basically been encapsulated in that table. And at the moment, that is our policy statement. You go edit that table to say whether it requires this kind of credential or not to do a particular operation. So summary is security explicit, delegation explicit, as all through credentials, as described in the SFA document, is what we're doing in Planet Lab today.
Okay, I'm going to go through a bunch of this quickly because a lot of it is similar to what Steve and Larry have already said. Our strategy in the security model that we're designing for Protogenie is that the design is more ambitious than the current implementation, right? We're sort of designing for so that we can do a simple model now and then later without, you know, reissuing certificates and so forth, right? We can go to a more complex model. So at the moment, what we're doing is, you know, we're assuming a fairly high degree of trust between the different federates in the system, and we're assuming a flat trust structure so that basically every federate in the system sort of directly knows about and trusts every other federate, and there's no levels of hierarchy on top of that. The idea behind the design is that eventually we'll be able to have trust not be a complete graph where everyone is trusting everyone else, and also to have sort of a federation structure where you might have say, for example, a U.S. Genie that vouches for the U.S. aggregates and which may in turn vouch for sub-sized authorities or something like this, and then out, and then another that you federate with that's similarly hierarchical in Europe or Asia or whatever. One sort of central feature of our model is that all of the parties trust the clearinghouse, and I'll show you what this looks like in just a moment. We are, like Larry described and like Steve mentioned, we are using attribute-based authorization. So authentication is not enough to prove that you have the right to do something. You also have to have a credential that basically is a signed statement that you have that right. And you know, we're using standard stuff like X509 certificates and whatever when possible. So this is what our PKI looks like, and I put PKI in quotes because it's incredibly simple, right? The basic idea is that every member of the federation is a certificate authority, and we use what I would call sort of like the browser model, right, where everybody has a set of root CAs that they're willing to accept, and then that set is basically managed by the clearinghouse. So it looks something like this. So if we have three federates here in a clearinghouse, each federate has its own root certificate. It communicates that root certificate with the clearinghouse, and then any other member of the federation can basically contact the clearinghouse and get the set of root CAs. So basically, in this model, each federate has to establish trust only directly with the CA, and then trust that all the certificates that the CA gives them are going to be for other trustworthy entities. And there's nothing in here that prevents us eventually from having a federate, you know, add some more routes that it trusts. And sort of certificate revocation lists, similarly, the clearinghouse is the central point where everybody posts and downloads certificate revocation list. So this is an extremely simple PKI. So to authenticate a user, basically a slice authority signs a authentication certificate for its users, and basically we simply check the signature, the entity that signed that certificate against the root CA set. Right now, this is, as I said, this is a flat structure. In the future, we plan to expand this so that basically you can have a chain of signatures that lead back to some trusted root, and the client certificate would have to include basically that entire chain so that it is by itself enough to be validated. And as I mentioned, the clearinghouse is a place to post and get certificate revocation lists. As far as credential goes, since Steve talked about this a bit, I'm not going to go through it too much. But essentially, there is every call takes a credential. That credential basically has a target object, such as a particular slice, particular component, particular sliver. It is signed by the authority that has authority over that target object, and a user can delegate a credential to another user by basically signing a new credential, granting the new user the right, and then including the old credential inside of the new one so that it can be traced back to the actual initial decision. Big issues that I don't think that we're that we or the CFA or SFA documents are really resolving right now is we've talked a number of times about what specifically a GID should be and whether it should be self-certifying and whether it should be separate identity and authentication, and I think we've gone around in circles on this a number of times, and I don't think there's an answer in the CFA right now. In our current design, we need a notion of ownership of various slice and component and user identities to prevent against malicious or buggy authorities. So essentially, authorities cannot sign certificates for identifiers that belong to other authorities. I mentioned that we'd like to do this hierarchical trust thing, and we have to actually try this out. And there are some authorization models, well, like for example, the one currently used by Emulab, that don't really obey a strict hierarchy, and I would like to see how we can fit that into a view to come up with a view of slice authorities that takes that properly into account. And that's it for me. And who's up next?
Yeah, I actually forgot that Steve asked me to do this, so it's consequently I have no slides, which is probably all for the best, but it's a good thing I was here since my working group is meeting next door. In Orca, the general outlines are sort of similar to what we've heard. Every actor, which are basically servers corresponding to aggregate manager, clearinghouse, and an entity running on behalf of the experimenter, slice controller. All of these actors have key pairs. The control plane exchanges are protected with WS security. And so the tricky questions become, how do we initially sort of endorse one of these servers as acting on behalf of a particular identity? How does an identity sort of initially sort of connect into one of these and get it to speak for it? And there's some issues there. We do use we do have hooks in web portal for shibboleth-based authentications based on a institutional shibboleth identity provider. And then there's the next question is how do you endorse that a particular actor running with a particular public key is running on behalf of a particular identity? And there's a little step there. That's something that we've actually been talking to some folks in Shibboleth to try to use some of the support that they've got there. And that's actually been proposed for Spiral too. But generally the issue then becomes what authorization, what powers do you give to somebody with a particular particular public key at all different levels of the system? And we're completely on board with the notion of attribute-based access control and endorsements by a privileged entity or some endorser that issues a credential that a particular public key or the possessor of the corresponding private key is empowered to do a certain thing. So there's a model associated with each of the objects, slices and reservations and leases and so on, that a particular public key or set of public keys is empowered to do specific operations on those and upcalls into that to do essentially ACL-based checks. And those are easily, that kind of a model is easily extended to process a delegation of endorsement from one of the privileged entities to somebody else who's trying to do the operation. Part of this access attribute-based access control idea is that there is a notion that you can make authorization decisions based on attributes of an identity and not necessarily without actually knowing what the identity actually is, based on statements made about it from some other empowered entity. And one example of that actually that we have in Orca is the delegation of privilege to use a particular resource, which is a decision made by a policy module in a clearinghouse. It issues tickets using this SHARP model that Steve alluded to, which are digitally signed statements by the clearinghouse, by the broker, as we call it, that it is that the public key or the holder of the corresponding private key is empowered to use particular resources at a particular aggregate at particular times. And that actually serves both as an authorization statement and also to endorse the public key of the user such that the aggregates don't actually really need to be involved in authentication or knowing even who, in principle, they don't need to even know who on whose behalf they're serving as long as they trust the broker to issue those kinds of statements of privilege. And there's a delegation of power to the broker for that as well, which is another digitally signed statement. So, again, the tricky question that we're actually struggling with in terms of implementation is what's the most elegant way to maintain all the state that's associated with the powers of a particular public key? And we are using this WSS4J, Orca's All in Java, the Scirocco lease manager. That's the basis for our implementation, is all in Java. And we use this WSS4J module, which does seem to have, it's based on these OASIS standards, but it does have built into it, in its key store and it's the information that it maintains about public keys, it's sort of built-in notion that it's working with a PKI. So you have to actually pass X509 certificates around in order to get information into the key stores. And that's actually something that's a little bit inelegant. So we are actually looking at, if anybody has experience with the SAML toolkits that the Shibboleth people are using, we'd actually like to have a better way of making security assertions, as in attribute-based access control, that can be used as a basis for delegating these powers. The approach that we're using to actually represent our tickets is a little bit ad hoc in that respect.
So I also forgot about it, and I do have a slide, so I take the easy, cheap way out by just asking questions. You know, we're talking about very strict security in here, and I think we should be realistic that our test beds will always be in a state of flux. I think Chip's e-commerce model doesn't really work because Amazon loses millions of dollars if the website is down for 5 minutes. And they have like a whole army of engineers which basically go through all the quality control and making sure that everything works. We'll have a couple of grad students who are trying to take some new resource and trying to hook it in, and things will always break. I think that's just the reality. And so is this black box service abstraction we're talking about, where you know you give your certificate and then it will do what you ask it for, and it will always work? I think it's just not realistic for most cases. So I think we need to allow experimenters to look under the hood, measure the environment, and sort of figure out what's going on here, because there's normally nobody to call, or not at midnight, 5 minutes before a big deadline. So, but what does that mean? I think Dave this morning talked about this whole sort of tension here between isolation and privacy, and actually trying to figure out why things are not working. Coming back to things break all the time, I actually want to be able to find the experiments I was using, the experiments I ran which were using a disk which failed, over the all the experiments I did over the last 2 weeks. We have this all the time. Things break, we have faulty disks, we have buggy drivers, which people realize, and it may not be that they're failing, they're just often just giving you the wrong results, or the measurements are off because somebody forgot to really screw in the antenna properly, so you immediately lose a couple of dBs, which suddenly all your measurements are off. So we need to capture all those things so that we can go back and fix them. And one sort of real sort of use case I'm really fond of, how do we actually deal with running experiments on top of other experiments? We have this one example in where we have a mesh network, and we want to be able to allow experimenters to basically offer mesh routing protocols to people who are working on services on top of mobile devices. So you can then choose different routing protocols or different ways the mesh network behaves, so you can see how your services work. But now, how do you actually, is this just a black box? And if then some measurements come out of the, or some results come out of the things you're running and on top of it, who owns that? And how do we, again, on the security level, how do we resolve that? So basically, I just want to throw out a lot of questions. I don't have any good answers. I have lots of opinions, but I think this is the right forum to ask those questions. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Ted Faber. This is some work we've been doing on Tide Security with John McCloskey and Steve Schwab. Let me stop doing that. When John sent the mail around, he sort of asked us to describe what we think the problem is. And so I'm going to spend a couple seconds here talking about what I think the hard problems are in Genie security. Basically, we've got traditional security problems. We've got a bunch of people who want to do stuff, and we need to decide whether or not they can do it in a particularly challenging environment. And the challenging environment comes in two flavors. First of all, it's big, 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 or we hope it'll be big, big, big. So that means it scales across several interesting axes. First of all, you've got many guys trying to give you resources. I'm from Tide, so I think we should federate with everybody who's got two nickels to rub together and can buy a server. But even if you believe in a sort of a more centralized clearinghouse model, you still want many resource providers to come to your clearinghouse, and you need to authenticate. You know, they'll have different constraints on their resources and this and that and the other thing. There's lots of them. Hopefully we'll have many experimenters. Experimenters are going to have different, we're going to have to identify a bunch of them, and they're all going to have different constraints on how they want to use things. In a big world like this, you want to make your authentication decisions in a distributed fashion. You don't want to always come to one central spot for authentication, and you really can't because everybody's got their own little policies to enforce. And then finally, as Max just said, part of the problem of a big world is that something's always busted. So it's you've got an always broken infrastructure. Any big infrastructure is going to have to confront those problems. Genie is particularly interesting, and it's a big infrastructure in which you want to do experiments. So we're deliberately trying to break stuff on Genie. That would be our plan. So breaking things can have wide effects. In the good case, you break things in a way that makes changes paradigms and things move forward. In the bad case, you accidentally DOS somebody. In either case, you'd really like, you know, your security needs to be prepared for that. Secondly, experimenters do unexpected things. You need a security system that's going to let them ask to do unexpected things and be allowed to do unexpected things. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about those challenges in more detail, and then I'm going to tell you about our Tide directions. Steve already talked a little bit about them when he talked about ABAC. Basically, the two key features of the way we'd like to move forward in Tide are that we're going to disconnect trust establishment, how do I decide who you are, from authorization decisions, how do I decide what you can do. And then I want to talk about the attribute-based reasoning we're going to make those decisions, and then we'll talk about that very briefly. First problem with scales. You've got a lot of resource providers and experimenters. Any security system is going to constrain them. The question is, to what extent and in what ways are you going to constrain them? You constrain resource providers in too many ways, you get fewer applications, you get fewer donations of technology. And if Genie is going to grow into a giant ecosystem, we want to encourage people to come to us. Specific problems raised by these many players, first of all, there's many trust models. If you've been running your lab based on Kerberos and you show up in Genie and then we say, oh, well, first thing you need to do is install a Shibboleth server, that's a little, you know, that's an extra hurdle we'd like to avoid for these guys. So we'd like to minimally constrain the trust formation aspect of this, and that is exactly what Shibboleth or Kerberos or those guys all do, and then interoperate between those trust models. Second thing is there's going to be, you know, every different resource provider, every different resource player is going to have different constraints on their resources. We need to be able to describe those constraints and potentially enforce those constraints. Finally, any negotiation between a provider and somebody who wants to use those resources is going to be an exchange of information. Some of that information is very explicit. Here's my identifier, here's my credentials, here's what I want to do. Some of that will be implicit. This guy wouldn't have asked this question if he didn't know he could respond to a challenge using this thing. And so it's sort of interesting to track that information flow, both what accidentally gets out and who I have to talk to in order to authorize. What are the flows of communication that are essential to making such a request? Large infrastructure, again, big world, something's always down. The security architecture has to expect partition and disconnection. So you want a decentralized authority. You want to be able to have fail-safe semantics. So you want to probably be able to continue, even if you're partitioned, to be allowing some range of authentication authorization decisions to be made. A good analogy here is ATMs. Even if the ATM can't reach its local bank machine, it will authenticate you and let you take a certain amount of money out. Maybe Genie needs to do the same sort of thing in order to limp forward. You might be able to get, a couple nodes, but we won't let you have the big router unless we can make a more concrete collection. This is not about slice revocation. It's about operating your authentication in that area. Secondly, we need clear auditable semantics and logs. We need to be able, number one, if you're actually operating in a partitioned world, it'd be nice to be able to replay those logs when you get connected and have, restore your central, your shared distributed structure, and you also want to be able to carry out human audits. The semantics of your security architecture need to be experiment-driven. Genie is built to do experiments, so there are specific experimental things you need to take into account when you're looking at an authorization decision. Experimenters will use resources for a reason, and they'll use them for a specific way. It's one thing to allow somebody to transit packets across the network that you've donated to Genie. It's another thing to allow them to transit packets that you know are going to be part of a simulated DDoS attack. In one case, you may be willing to accept that challenge, in the other, you wouldn't. If you approach this stuff from a sort of a traditional authorization, yes, no, kind of, anybody, can they use the resource? You might make one decision, but can you make the resource, can you use the resource for a given reason is another decision. Okay. Secondly, any security architecture you put in place is going to constrain the kinds of experiments you can run. An easy example of this is if your security architecture allows you to have anonymous principles, there are a certain set of experiments on anonymity that you can run that you probably can't run if you don't allow anonymous principles. The purpose here is to make sure that we understand the constraints that our security architecture is putting in place and choose wisely. As Steve said, Tide is looking to put ABAC, the Sparta-developed attribute-based reasoning system, into place. Principles assert attributes about other principles. Formal reasoning drives any authentication decisions. There's a set of formal language of how you can combine attributes to make a security decision. Nice system. The things I want to call out here is that the principal trust can be established by many ways. You can, there are any number of ways I can establish you are the principal I think you are. From there on out, the rule-based system takes over and I do the analysis. Because this rule-based system is formally well-defined, we can promote both human understanding of the kind of decisions that are being made and do formal analysis of it in the hopes of keeping track of what we're doing. Our choice here was driven by these Genie requirements. First of all, that it has these clear interfaces from which we can construct audit logs, from which we can do these various things. And secondly, that it forms a usable system. The basis of it is already in our Tide control framework that we demoed yesterday. So there's some amount of sort of proof that it's not getting in the way too much, or that I can code security stuff. I don't know what the solution is there, but we do strongly believe that it creates a usable system. How does this, let me give me one more sort of argument that this particular organization, this ABAC thing, helps and where it helps. First of all, these multiple trust establishment models is important because it helps us decide how can we negotiate with who. And can we reach out to the broadest audience for these things? Formal descriptions let us know very explicitly what can we say, what kind of questions can we ask, what kind of access can we authorize. And it also lets us look at it formally and say, does our authorization model get in the way of a class of experiment? Clear decisions, we can look back at an audit log and say, what happened? What rights were given out here? And exactly why were they given out? And secondly, those can be used to reconcile the decisions. If you have two decisions that were made by two different users or two different authorities in a partitioned space, if those authorities get back together, because the stuff has all been formally written out and understood, there's a possibility they can combine those into a single unified understanding. And then finally, there's design guidance. This helps you design your actual authorization protocols. Who has to say what? What information has to flow between the various players in order to make a valid authorization decision? What has to be up to be able to make a valid authorization decision? at what point in the authorization protocol can we start doing disconnected operation? These are the kind of questions we can ask and answer using this formal mechanism. And then finally, what have I let you know? At the end of the game, what if two players let each other know other than explicit credentials? That's all I have to say. I'd like to thank you for listening, and we'll talk.
Okay, so we're in the discussion phase, and Aaron will ask the first question.
You're gonna ask me?
actually, this is it's a question that many of you may have a response to. So based on my understanding of the different control frameworks, when you allow users into the system, there's two strategies that are in use. One is user basically sends an email or completes a form, provides an email address, a person gets involved and does some web snooping or other informal methods for validating that they are, in fact, who they say they are, and then grants them access to the system. The other approach, which I think Jeff is the only one using, is that they're using the Shibboleth system for doing the human identification of, is this person affiliated with this institution? Are they who they say they are? So first, just point of fact, is am I wrong? Is there another strategy that's in use in any of the clusters? So, John, do you want to answer? Or maybe Steve, since you're familiar, maybe you can answer for everyone.
Let me see. I've been wandering around in some sense, interviewing or looking over the shoulder of everybody building control frameworks. So Emulab and Deter, I believe, use the there's some vetted PI, principal investigator, through some process.
So what's the process? I mean, that's what I'm asking about, is how do you bootstrap letting somebody into the system? Because I think this is a problem that doesn't scale well in the way it's currently in use in existing control frameworks.
So the process in both of those systems has been we tie back to that principal investigator in some sense. Are they at an institution we know of? Do we know who they are? Or do we have some other separate email communications channel where we, meaning the testbed resource owners, acquire some confidence that we're dealing with a person who represents themselves to be part of the research community? So normally, this is not never... I don't think in Deter or Emulab is it typically in doubt that we can't identify who we're dealing with. I mean, occasionally we do get, I know in Deter we occasionally get a request from somebody who we just can't identify, who they are, really. And we will typically not just simply grant access to the testbed for that. And I think, I don't know how the models evolved at Emulab, but JLabPro also used to have sort of a similar system of, it's...
I think Rob wants to answer that.
I was just going to say that I think that the that a simple hierarchical model does actually scale really, really, really well, right? So even if the vetting of an individual takes a little while, right? The idea of approving a project and then letting that project approve its own members, or approving an institution and letting that institution approve its own members, like Planet Lab does. I mean, I don't see a scaling problem there.
But I'm kind of surprised to hear you guys say that. Given the rigor at which you guys come at security, to say basically you're using sort of people or people who are you can find on the internet, in some way that you think is reliable. Go ahead, John. I do have a point I'm trying to get to here.
Okay, so I think it's a busted question, right? Because the result of, you've really got two phases, right? So what happens when you send the email, right? You get a certificate, or you get put into the Shibboleth database, or you get a Kerberos ID or whatever. Or alternatively, you register to go to the University of West Bicycle State and you get a Shibboleth ID, or you get a Kerberos ID, or you get a certificate or whatever, right? There's really two separate steps there. And so comparing step A of some of the test beds with step B of some of the other ones is a little weird. I think that to sort of reiterate a point that I think at least two or three of these folks made, there are several mechanisms for establishing sort of primary identity. And those, one perspective is Genie should have its own. And another perspective, which I think is the one most folks are taking, is no, we've already got institutions to do that, and we've already got, you know, every university in sight has some mechanism for joining that university community. And then if you have a delegation mechanism, if you have particularly the sort of mechanism that Ted's talking about, you can make statements that don't apply to individual people. They apply to members of that university's community or whatever. And we don't have to say the way you join the community is send the email, right? Because we don't care. What we care about is if you're a member of this community, then somebody already knows that. And you go from there.
So there's one other point to probably make, which is, are we in the technical domain or in a policy domain, right, for this bootstrapping step?
Well, actually, I think this is one of the important points where they meet, you know, that you know, so, you know, the way that I view it is that you want some institution to, in some way, vouch for users, right, to say this person is who they say they are, and, you know, and I'm taking responsibility for that assertion. You know, maybe for nothing else. It seems so, and so my understanding is that this is basically all that you get out of Shibboleth, right? You get an assertion that this person is associated with this institution, and that the attributes associated with Shibboleth are really confined to that level of assertion. Meaning that, you know, in common, the federation of universities who support this stuff, you can't just put special purpose attributes in there, that they give you the attributes that they support. That it seems to me that this might be something. I think this is an important piece of the design that, I think I disagree with Rob. That doesn't seem to me that that's going to scale very well. I mean, we keep talking about, you know, coming up with a design that's going to scale well, and I think that's sort of the PIs known to individuals or the ad hoc support lots of different techniques for identifying who people are. Neither of those are really going to scale particularly well, and I think that at least having sort of a default or a preferred method for how people are identified to just be who they say they are as sort of the entry point to the system. And not to say that, you know, I'm not suggesting that you want to propagate that technology all the way through the control plane. I think that actually probably you would have to, you know, switch to something that is more designed around Genie. You know, it might be that you do, you know, for example, Shibboleth, you know, to get the person identified, and then the ABAC stuff inside as a way of adding additional sort of Genie-related attributes through. But I think that I am proposing that Shibboleth might be a reasonable starting point for how you do the identity, and then, you know, if we could agree on that and move on and focus on doing actually the stuff that there isn't an existing candidate solution for elsewhere on how you propagate the special attributes and credentials and roles to the system.
Did you want to go, Steve?
No, I think there's maybe just one comment here, which is there's a near-term, what's workable in the near-term strategy and what the growth of researchers coming to Genie will look like over time, right? So there's a danger of getting over-engineering a solution for 2009 or 2010. Not to say we're not going to plan for a large increase in researchers, but we probably do need to get an estimate of what the size of the universe is here and what the space is. You know, so how many of our expected researchers would probably already have a Shibboleth ID? If we think that's covers, you know, the common case, then it makes sense as a good default technology. But in many cases, the researchers in the networks and distributed systems community are going to come to Genie right away, are already pretty tightly tied, at least in the U.S., to folks who are already involved in the project. And I think the we're making it, it's sort of a non-problem for I think, the first couple of years.
Yeah, well, and punting to Shibboleth is a great plan, but I think you should punt to whatever. And Shibboleth just ties assertions to people. Just ties attributes to people.
So, So I believe it's not so much shibboleth as the technology that I think is particularly appealing. I think it's in common as the Federation of Universities who already have policies and procedures for how you vouch for an individual. So the universities have internal ways of doing this.
Right, and if I as a resource owner decide that's what I want to hear, that's great. If I want to know that you shook hands with the director of my lab, that's great too. I can get that attribute a bunch of places. What I want to avoid doing is if I've actually got a guy who's at an interesting university who wants to join Genie, and the first thing you say to him is bring a shibboleth server up, and he says, well,
right. So I think that's a realistic point. And if there's, I guess Rick's not in the room, but I think that my understanding of shibboleth is far from perfect, but I believe that you can have both anonymous access and sort of general purpose identity providers, so that you could have an alternative shibboleth server if your institution doesn't support it. And you could continue to use the technology.
You've got to find somebody to vouch for you.
Right, and so you can. So in common solves a vouching problem for a set of institutions, and then
I think that's a set of shared attributes, right? That's an attribute ontology.
They're a federation of universities.
Right. They've agreed to hand out the same attributes.
Yes. And they've solved sort of the human part of the policies to get the institutions to agree to that. I mean, if you've dealt with USC legal department, you understand that that's
right. And USC is an example of a group who might not be in common because we've got our own shibboleth servers.
So at this point, I want to punt to somebody who knows more about the technology rather than trying to get into that. I think John wants to
say. Well, we can. It's 5:35. I want to see if there are other folks who want to say anything about this. Okay, so I think we're adjourned as a group, and then I think a small group of us will probably go discuss with Aaron the error of his perception here. So. All right, thanks a lot, guys. We're going to, I'll close up on this a little bit. We're going to do a couple of things. We'll be posting all these slides, and then there are some themes that have come out of this that we'll try and extract and send to the list for the larger audience that was at the other two working groups, all of whom were like, oh, I want to go to three groups. Rob Ritchie, in particular, has muxed himself among three groups. It's some kind of slicing technique, so I'm not sure how he did it, but yeah. All right.